Scene. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It is 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, we're going to be replaying a memorable conversation from 2010 with journalist Jim Murray, talking about his memoir, The Last Day of My Life. In part two, we're going to be hearing from the founder and president of Milwaukee's Air and Water Show, which is coming up this weekend. Here is part one.
It's a very special pleasure and honor for me to be speaking for the next few minutes with journalist Jim Murray. I'm sure many of you know his name, his voice, his face. For well over two decades, he has been a very prominent force and face. You maybe know him as a chief correspondent for Inside Edition, done great work for CNN and for other networks as well. And you might remember him as co-anchor of CNN's main newscast, The World Today, and an anchor for a time of CNN's Newsnight. His book, just published, is an extraordinarily personal book, which certainly touches on the fascinating professional life which he has enjoyed. But much deeper than that, explores some of the lessons which he has learned in a life which has been touched by great blessing and by some great difficulty as well. The book is called The Last Day of My Life. It springs out of a question which Jim Murray posed to himself at a very dark moment in his life. And the insights which sprang from that question of what if this were my last day of life helped to clarify for him in a very powerful way what matters most in life, and the way in which he intended to live out his life, whatever life was remaining to him. And this eloquent book is published by Phoenix Books, and I'm very, very pleased that for the next few minutes we can speak with Jim Murray about his book. Again, it's called The Last Day of My Life. Jim Murray, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Greg, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So describe to our listeners how far you had fallen, the sort of despair in which you found yourself, and then that question which you found yourself posing to yourself.
Well, I mean, I suppose like millions of Americans, I was caught up in the mortgage meltdown. You know, so many people today are worried about keeping their homes and their jobs and losing their retirement accounts. When I left CNN many years ago, I went through a couple of years where I didn't work, and I relied on my house to keep me afloat. And so I took out a loan and basically lit the fuse to a bomb that would go off years later, when I'd actually landed on my feet and reestablished my career at Inside Edition and was doing quite well, but found myself so upside down in my house and terrified of losing everything that I really fell into a horrible despair. And one day when leaving an assignment, I was driving on a stretch of road in the hills above Malibu. And I'd been in this area before, but never on this road. And it was a very windy road with a steep cliff to one side, no guardrail. And my thoughts turned very dark. And I thought, this is the perfect spot to go over the edge. And it would look like an accident, and my family would get a multi-million-dollar insurance policy, and everything would be fine. And it was really like Jimmy Stewart standing on that bridge in It's a Wonderful Life. But instead of thinking, what if I had never lived, I really stopped the car and I thought, because it was a wake-up call to me, what if I had only one day? What if this were my last day? How would I view my life and what is important in my life? And my family, basically, even though they weren't with me, saved me from going over that hill, because it was my thoughts of my three children and my wife, imagining my own funeral, thinking, what kind of legacy is this to leave to them, and how hurt would I leave them? And I went home and I started writing, and I remember showing my wife after I'd written a couple of chapters, and she started to cry and said, do you really feel like this? Because I hadn't discussed it with her, and it's a very difficult thing to talk about. And I said, this is exactly how I feel. And she said, you know, I love you, and our kids love you, and we want you here, and I don't care where we live, and, we want you here. Why? I want you to talk to me, and I want you to keep writing, and because it was really pouring out of me, and I wrote and wrote, and it was really a cathartic experience for me, not intending it to be a book. And after I'd written a certain amount, my wife said, you know, there's more here. Keep telling your story. There's a book here. There's something that other people may be able to relate to. And so I started looking at my life in terms of friendship and love and gratitude and tenacity and sacrifice and commitments. And I looked at the value of laughter and music and adventure. And none of the things that I was writing had anything to do with money. And you could have a full bank account and an empty life, and many of us are finding the lower bank accounts, wondering what the value of life is. And I suspect that at the end, you're going to be measured, really, by the relationships and the people you touch and the kind of person you are. And that helped me refocus the priorities. So it really took away the stigma and the shame and enabled me to go forward and say, this is how I choose to live, whatever happens, because we're all going to have challenges. We'll have some great periods and some bad periods, but this is how I choose to live.
That may be the answer to this question you write as you tell this story of that ride through the country and those thoughts of suicide. You say, it was in this blackest moment that I had an epiphany. And I think just now you ultimately described sort of what that epiphany was, that it was a seeing with some clarity a new set of priorities, a new understanding of what is most important in life. But I suspect that that wasn't all clear in an instant. What was clear in that blackest moment?
The thing that was clear is that I had to stop the car and not go over. And I couldn't even express why, other than to see my family's faces, you know, my kids and my wife. I couldn't really explain to you a true understanding, because I didn't have one yet. And this was really a months-long process of mining my own experiences and looking at the relationships that I'd had with family and with friends and the lessons that they taught me, that it became clearer to me what I was to do. But I knew the epiphany was, this is the wrong thing to do, going over that cliff.
One of the things I'm really struck by in reading your book and probing into your story is that there are many ways in which your story is different from the typical story. I mean, just the fact that you have enjoyed this career of great prominence in journalism and show business, that you have a father who is very, very famous, who we will talk about, and so on. I mean, there are many outward ways, especially, in which your life is a very uncommon life. And yet, ultimately, what you write about in this book and the lessons you have learned have very little, if anything, directly to do with being famous or being rich or any of the things that make your particular life rather distinctive and uncommon. I wonder if you could just talk a moment about that interesting combination that we find in your book, your uncommon story in terms of its specifics, but the commonality of the lessons that we learn there.
Well, the way that I broke up the book, when I talk about friendship and love and commitment, you know, I think that there are experiences that we all share. Many of us have lost friends. We certainly all have a friend or two that we consider dear to us. Many of us are married. Some of us have had marital problems. Some have gotten divorced. Others have reconciled. You know, there are certain universal themes, and I think that today especially, I mean, I don't think that I was alone in feeling a sense of hopelessness or helplessness. I think that many people feel that, and I think that the thing that we share are really the people that we touch and who touch us in our lives, and the themes of commitment and sacrifice and apology and forgiveness. I don't think that it matters if you have $20,000 or $2 million. I think that you experience those very same feelings, and I think that there's a universality to that. Hmm.
I mentioned that you have a very famous father, and that would be actor and singer James Dearen. You call him one of the first all-American idols. That's
yeah.
a good way to describe him. But he and your mother divorced when you were very, very young. And it was a divorce that was very painful and even bitter. And much of what you experienced as a young person sprang out of some of this pain. And in particular, a very difficult decision which was ultimately made about what name you would bear and officially whose son you would be. Just talk for a moment about some of this pain and ultimately what you came to learn about yourself and about life from all of that difficulty.
Well, the fact of coming from a broken home is not novel. I mean, millions of kids do. What made my situation so difficult was that my father was on TV. So my mother would see him, I would see him. You know, he was never out of the picture because he's literally in the picture, on the screen. That makes it difficult, and I suspect it made it more difficult for my mom because she was always reminded of his presence. And people knew about him, and so they knew he was my father. But they had a very, very contentious divorce, and my mom would go to school and change my last name, and you know, my father would then change it back. He'd say, that's not his name. It was horrible, and to be the kid in the middle, to be that ping pong ball, it did shape, I'll tell you what it did. It shaped my view of how I would be as a parent, and I have to say right out, I love my parents, and I don't blame them for anything, and they didn't ruin me, and they didn't, you know, they didn't damage me, but there is an effect when you have a divorce. And my wife and I talked about this when we were at one point going through difficulties, that we would never do that to our kids, because no matter what, my wife is my kid's mom, and I want them to respect their mom and love their mom. And my folks were very young when I was born, and I suspect that it was their youth that really was at the root of so many of the problems, because it was so early in their life. My mom was 16 when she was married and pregnant, and 16, just under 17 when I was born. So, you know, she was still a kid herself. So in many ways, we grew up together, I suspect. Hmm. But you know what? I have to say I've had a great childhood, and even through all that turmoil and pain, I did ultimately, and it took me 50 years to do it, I finally had to stop holding my breath and let go and say, you know what, my parents aren't perfect. I love them. They have their own issues. I'm not going to be a part of it. Mm. And that took years and years and years. And finally, that's where I am now. I hope I'm mature and can say, I can love you both. This isn't a battle. It's not about who I love more, and it never was.
I think one of the most interesting moments in the book is when you you tell us about this moment when it was decided that you would be adopted by your mother's new husband, your stepfather, and your biological father, James Dearen, ultimately agreed to that with very mixed feelings, of course. And you came to understand eventually that your father really believed that you had been stolen from him in that adoption transaction. And you write this: to this day, my father believes that I was stolen from him. It is not necessary for me to agree with him, but I do acknowledge and understand his feelings. I think that is a distinction that most of us are not very good at, that if we don't agree with something, we don't necessarily find it possible then to acknowledge that or try to understand how that other person feels. And I think that really shows a lot of wisdom on your part, that that you can maybe disagree with your father on this matter, and yet you work very hard to come to understand and acknowledge his pain.
Well, I appreciate that. I mean, I mean, ultimately, it comes down to love. And as a parent, I feel what I would consider unconditional love toward my kids, and I guess that I feel that toward my parents too. So sometimes you may not understand, you may not agree, but that doesn't mean you don't love them. And all I was really trying to say to him, because I also include him in this chapter on forgiveness, where I basically forgive what was a very painful experience for me, and that was the adoption. I don't even have to understand it to forgive. And the forgiveness is a liberating experience for me, because I could let go. And I could say, you know what? I have a dad. I have a father. I love you both. Both of them were born on the same date. I mean, you can't get any closer than that. And they both had one interest, and that was my best interest. At least I believe that. And I believe they both love me, and I love them. And it's not a competition. And I know that it's very painful for my father, but that doesn't mean I don't love him.
Hmm. We're speaking with Jim Murray, and we're talking about his book called The Last Day of My Life. And in this book, Jim Murray explores all kinds of things which he's come to regard as very important building blocks in a full, rich, wonderful life. Things like gratitude and friendship and forgiveness and understanding and compassion. One of the really interesting moments in the book where we do learn something about your work as a journalist is in the chapter called Compassion, Feeling Sympathy or Sorrow for Another Along with a Desire to Relieve that Suffering. And in some respects, you give us wonderful examples of what compassion is all about in some of the encounters you have had professionally with people like Fred Goldman, the father of the slain Ron Goldman. Tell us about this memorable interview which you did with Mr. Goldman, and a fairly simple yet important example of the compassion you tried to have for him in that difficult moment.
Well, one thing that I've always taken to heart is this sense of responsibility I have as a journalist, and that is that when I tell stories, it affects people, and it certainly affects those who are involved in the story. And on this particular night, it was right after the O.J. Simpson criminal verdict came in, not guilty. And Ron Goldman was the guest. I was filling in for Larry King. And seated alongside him was Dan Petrocelli, who is his attorney for the upcoming civil trial. And when I was talking to Fred Goldman, you're talking to a man who believes with all of his heart that his son was murdered by O.J. Simpson, and O.J. Simpson was basically found not guilty and exonerated. And Fred started to cry on air. And I, instead of going in for the kill, like most people think journalists want to do, I went immediately to his lawyer and asked him a question to give Fred a time to gain his composure and regain his composure. And when I got home, I didn't really give it a thought, to be honest with you, but when I got home, I got a message from the network saying that the Goldmans would like me to call them. So I called them, and Fred Goldman got on the phone, and he said he just wanted to thank me for showing him the courtesy and respect to not turn this into a circus on television. And he had a moment where he was overcome with emotion, understandably, and I let him handled it with dignity rather than making a mockery of it. And you know, that memory really serves to remind me about that responsibility, because I was very touched and I remain touched by that conversation. It's very important to me because I viewed that as a successful interview because I had gained his respect, and it means a great deal to me.
Hmm. And it was, of course, in some ways, a very simple gesture and yet tremendously meaningful gesture on your part, which probably was not even particularly, you yourself didn't even particularly take note of it, and maybe even the typical viewer watching it might not have even noticed that, but what an important gesture. Later in that chapter, you talk about doing a very challenging interview with entertainer George Michael in the wake of his arrest on a misdemeanor charge of lewd conduct. And this is another example in which it was a situation tremendously difficult for him and challenging for you as the person doing the first lengthy interview with him. Talk a moment about the way in which you went about trying to make that all that it ultimately was.
Well, that was an interview. It was significant for him because, unbeknownst to me at the time, the British tabloids were planning, apparently, to out him as being gay that weekend. And so I had the interview on Friday night, and our agreement was that it would air Friday night, Saturday morning in England. And we did it on tape, and that was the agreement, live to tape. He was so nervous, and this is a man who's used to standing in front of, you know, tens of thousands of people and performing, but in a one-on-one situation, he was clearly nervous and jittery, and I tried to explain to him that this was not a persecution, it wasn't a prosecution, it was simply a conversation. And he came in the interview and with what I didn't realize at the time, but he wanted to preempt the British tabloids, and he revealed to me that he was gay, that he had been involved in this lewd conduct, he had done it before, and most important of all, he wanted to apologize to his fans, who he felt he had let down. And it was really the opportunity, in his mind, to do this with dignity and not be ridiculed and persecuted. And it was months later when I interviewed Elton John, where Elton John told me that George Michael was a very close friend of his and how much that interview meant to him. I didn't even realize it at the time, how significant that interview was for him. But he said, you know, the way you treated him with respect and kindness really made a difference, and thank you. And you know, it just reminds you that when you talk to people, you really do have a responsibility. I mean, I think that we just have a responsibility as people to be decent to one another. But I know that in our industry, we've earned or gained the reputation of being just jackals or vultures. And I don't really think that that's necessarily deserved, certainly not in all cases.
I want to make sure that we have time for you to tell a marvelous story about your son, Matthew. A story which you tell in a chapter called Miracles. And this is really a story about how miracles happen and that one should always cling to hope, even when there is something tremendously difficult. Explain to our listeners what your son Matthew was facing.
Well, about a year ago Thanksgiving, Matthew had been, what we thought was he had a broken ankle, and he had been in a cast for 6 weeks. Cast came off, still complaining. Pain got worse and worse and worse. We went to a series of doctors, and the pain continued to get worse. No one knew what was wrong with him. And eventually he got to a point where he would scream from the moment he'd wake up until he'd finally fall asleep late into the night from exhaustion. You couldn't even touch his foot. And we finally found a wonderful doctor at UCLA at the Pain Management Clinic, who diagnosed him as having a nerve injury, not a broken ankle, should never have been put in a cast. And it's the kind of injury where the nerve is sending a signal of pain to the brain, even though and there's no outward appearance of any injury. And it's a very difficult thing to diagnose, and it's very difficult to treat, and it's very rare in kids. And for 6 weeks, Matthew was unable to walk, I fashioned a foam pillow for his calf so that his foot would be suspended over the bed, because you couldn't even put a blanket on him. It would cause such searing pain. And my wife and I spent, I can't even tell you how many nights, crying because we were powerless to do anything. And the doctor who we finally found said, I can cure him. I wrote a book on this. I know what this is about. And to give you an idea of the pain, earlier doctors had given him methadone for a week, and it did nothing. I mean, the pain was so great. But this one doctor used physical therapy and various medications and some interesting thing called mirror therapy. And, you know, after 6 weeks or 7 weeks, one day, Matthew looked at me and said, "Daddy, my foot doesn't hurt on the bottom." And I said, "Really?" And then suddenly the normalcy returned all the way up his foot. And within 3 days, he was our Matthew again. And I have to tell you that when you're in the throes of this horrible situation and you're watching your child, your beautiful little boy, suffer, and you can't do anything about it, you really pray for anything. And this, to me, was as close to a miracle as I've ever seen. And I regard it as that, and I'm so grateful for it, that our little guy is healthy.
Hmm. And we learned so much in your book about what real gratitude is, and for not taking anything for granted, the blessings of the everyday, as well as mountaintop moments like this. In the last few moments we have, describe to our listeners what you call the 24-hour checklist, which we find towards the back of the book.
I basically consider every day resetting my 24-hour clock. And you know, I envision every day as if it were my last and say, how do I want to live this day? And I wake up and I go through this mantra and I look in the mirror and I actually say out loud those things I'm grateful for. And I'm truly grateful for a lot. I've had wonderful opportunities. I have a wonderful, loving wife, 3 great kids. Our family is healthy. My wife's parents and my parents are alive and healthy. And then I go through this list that I call the 10 C's. And they're really words for me of empowerment. Calm, cool, connected, compassionate. And the last word, and I close my eyes, take a deep breath, is centered. And I open my eyes again, and I try to project a very positive attitude toward everything that I'm about to do that day. And it sounds silly, perhaps. It sounds simple. But when you have a positive attitude, it reflects back to you in all of the people that you deal with that day. And I really believe that it changes the day. And it may seem trite. It may seem trivial. But to me, it works. And for me, it works. And that's really all. I'm not suggesting that others do this, but this is how I choose to live, and that's the really important thing. You can make a choice in how you want to approach each day, and my choice is to approach it with wonder and embrace the day, even when there are challenges, and there will be challenges. I'm not suggesting that through this book that your life will be challenge-free, because there's sure to be a lot of challenges that none of us can foresee, but you can put them in a different perspective.
The book, The Last Day of My Life, is published by Phoenix Books. Its author, Jim Murray. Jim Murray, thank you so much for writing this very meaningful book and for joining me today on The Morning Show. I have enjoyed this.
Well, thank you so much. I have too, and you've been very gracious. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. And we're going to spend the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show talking about the latest iteration of something which has become quite a beloved and much anticipated part of the summer season in Milwaukee, the annual Milwaukee Air and Water Show. Founded back in 1994 by my morning show guest Paul Rogers, founder and president of the Milwaukee Air and Water Show, and this year's event is coming up on July 19th and 20th. And we're going to be finding out from Paul Rogers not only what is going to be offered up in this year's show, but also try to get a sense of what it is like to put this event together and the kind of details that are pretty much lost on the rest of us who just show up and enjoy the spectacular show without any notion whatsoever of all the coordination that is necessary to make all of this happen. Paul Rogers, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Great to be here, sir.
Ahead of us talking about the Air and Water Show, I think it would be good for people to get a little sense of your own background and the work that you have done in the past with both the U.S. Coast Guard and the U.S. Air Force, if I remember your biography correctly.
Absolutely. My history goes back, of course, U.S. Coast Guard Aviation and Wisconsin Air National Guard at the 128th Air Refueling Wing. So, worked on fixed-wing, rotor-wing airplanes, and, of course, that was a big part of my aviation background. And I guess sort of served as some inspiration as to what led me to start and found the Air and Water Show. And so it's always great to, you know, be around military aviation. And, of course, we have lots of that in the Air and Water Show. But the roots do go back to that background. And then as I started the air show, I got to learn how to host the teams and do everything that you need to do to put on a great air and water show. So I do owe a lot to my military aviation background, Coast Guard, Air National Guard. So all is a good background to talk about, and I love it. I love military aviation, and it's just a great thing to bring to Milwaukee and Wisconsin, I think.
What prompted you way back when to want to do this? And I'm not talking now about putting together this air show, but just wanting to fly. I mean, was anything or anyone in particular an inspiration to you directly?
Well, I had started flying when I was in the military. I got my private pilot's license, so that was a big part of the inspiration. And, you know, another part of it, Greg, was, you know, I wanted to, you know, start my own business and things like that. So I decided, hey, you know, an air show, there's not one in Milwaukee. You know, could be it's a great opportunity to, you know, to start a business and do what I love to do. And that's that was a big part of it. But, you know, I've been flying since I was 19, so that has quite a bit to do with it, I think.
I'm just curious, what got you wanting to fly in the first place? I mean, what made you want to kind of take that leap into the air, if you will?
Well, sir, truth be told, I was stationed at U.S. Coast Guard Air Station Traverse City, Michigan at the time, and had some friends that we would socialize with, and one of them was a guy by the name of Tom Belsky, and he was an instructor pilot at Northwestern Michigan College, as it turns out, and he took me for a private pilot ride, and after that, it was just all nothing but flying. So, you know, he convinced me, hey, what an idea to get your private pilot's license. So I did that when I was 20 years old up at Traverse City, Michigan, when I was stationed there at the air station. So after that, I did a lot of private flying. And, of course, my last air station was at Air Station Miami, and I did a lot of flying down there. So that's kind of how it happened. Hmm.
So take us back to the first of these air shows that you put together. If I understand correctly, that was way back in 1994. What kind of an undertaking was that for you, and was it kind of an intimidating challenge the first time around? Or had you been around air shows already and kind of already knew what would be involved in doing this?
I really hadn't been around air shows. I was involved with the Homestead Air Force Base Air Show briefly when I was at Air Station Miami with the Coast Guard, but it was new to me when I started the business, and I had to appear before airport commissions and other folks and with government, and so it was a challenge getting that going. But I had some help, of course, with some other people that were involved with other air shows, especially the Chicago Air and Water Show. There was a gentleman down there named Rudy Melnati who was kind of my mentor, and he helped me get a lot of the air show acts that you see flying in the air show today. So had a lot of help from him over the years, and it just basically progressed into the lakefront air show that you see now. But it was a lot of work in the background, you know, getting the teams together and raising the money and doing everything you need to do to make a successful air show. So it was definitely a number of years in the making to get it going. But once it got going, people loved it, and we're having a good time, you know, bringing the show back every year and raising the money. So it's all good.
Hmm. So tell us a little bit about the kind of groups that tend to be the headliners. I mean, for instance, sometimes the headliner, I think last year was the U.S. Air Force Thunderbirds. This year, I believe the headliner is the U.S. Navy Blue Angels. Tell us about groups like this. I mean, how they function, what they do throughout the year, and then how you end up connecting with them in order for them to be part of the Milwaukee event.
Absolutely. I mean, what you really have are two types of performers, the civilian and military. Milwaukee's become more of a military act, meaning, you know, jet teams like the Blue Angels and the Thunderbirds. Now, with those types of teams, there's a lot of competition nationwide to do that. So, you know, there's a lot of air shows that compete with getting the Blues and Thunderbirds, including military air shows. So you have to compete with them. But you have a lot of other performers. You know, there's other demo teams like the F-22, you know, F-35 teams. And then there's a lot of other military aircraft where people stationed across the country, they'd like to come and do their hometown air show. So people from Wisconsin that might be flying different at different military bases look out for air shows in their hometowns. And so what we do is we touch base with all those types of military teams and ask them, you know, would you like to fly, you know, in your hometown, in Milwaukee? So oftentimes it happens that way, not always, but it's a lot of work getting the Blues and Thunderbirds. You have to do what you need to do to you know, go through their checklist and treat the teams right, bring them to your city. And when that happens, they want to come back. And that's what we've done in Milwaukee. We've you know, done a great job with taking care of the jet teams when they come to Milwaukee, and they just love it. And they love Milwaukee, and they want to come back. And that's probably one of the biggest factors in the success of the Air and Water Show.
We're talking in this portion of the morning show with Paul Rogers, founder and president of the Milwaukee Air and Water Show, which this year is coming up on July 19th and 20th. So take us through the process by which the show itself gets put together in terms of when it's going to start, when it's going to end, and exactly where it's going to take place. I mean, is there something sort of like a script involved in terms of what happens and in what sequence and exactly where it's going to happen? I mean, what kinds of preliminary planning is involved in those kind of details?
Absolutely. So I think, you know, 90% of it is the pre-planning and fundraising to get, you know, to hit your budget so that all the bills get paid. And that's most of it. And then as you lead up to the show, I've created a number of checklists, which are too numerous to mention on this show, but there's a lot of things that you have to do to make sure that the air show, you know, comes off properly and everybody's taken care of, such as the sponsors. But then, you know, the week of the show, there's a lot of things that you have to do with the performers and making sure that, you know, everything's done properly. We have to do meetings with, you know, police, fire, Coast Guard, FAA, all the different agencies that are involved with the show. That's the 2 weeks leading up to the show. And then, of course, the Blues, Thunderbirds, they have their own particular schedules that you follow during the week leading up to the weekend, including the practice day, which is Friday. But, yeah, it's a lot of pre-planning. That's a big part of it, making sure that you got everything you need to do so that the air show goes off without a hitch and everybody's taken care of. But a lot of pre-planning, a lot of fundraising.
Hmm. I am especially curious about the whole matter of exactly where these aircraft fly. I mean, in what formation and exactly where everything takes place. Because, of course, that's one of the things that separates this from a lot of other spectator events that are exciting, is that you are seated in a stadium and the action is happening right in front of you or on the court or on the ice or whatever, but this is up in the sky, and in a sense it could be anywhere, but it of course happens in a particular place, a particular part of the sky, so the people who are gathered to see it can really enjoy it. How precisely planned does that have to be in terms of exactly where these maneuvers are going to take place?
A great question, Greg, and it's very precise. We have a set aero, what you call an aerobatic box. In this case, Blue Angels Thunderbird is 12,000 feet long, and it's out there on the water. Other air shows are at airports, so it's out over the runway that you pick. And there's the aerobatic box is very tightly controlled, and as far as the places where the aircraft come into the aerobatic box, which is where, of course, the spectators are looking out over the water, just kind of like a, you know, first row seat at a basketball game or whatever, like you mentioned. But there's very specific rules that we have to follow, and we have a certified, what we call an air boss, and you have to have that. That's required by FAA. So you got all the different rules and regulations set forth in what we call the waiver. The waiver is something that's a document where there's specific rules that we can follow, and we have to follow, I'm sorry, and just some expansion of those rules, like altitude and speed, for example. So obviously the airshow aircraft are moving fast, faster than a normal aircraft when there's not an airshow. So lots of rules that we got to follow. We have briefings. We have FAA rules, a rule book, so to speak, a playbook. And it all is designed for, number one thing, safety of the spectators, and to make sure that the air show goes off without creating any sort of safety hazard. So those rules must be followed. That's the air boss. That's the controller who makes that happen during the air show and with the announcer. And that's kind of how the air show works. So Blues, Thunderbirds have a specific, what we call support manuals. You got to follow all of those rules. And, of course, all the other military teams that perform have a set of rules as well. So it's a very specific set of guidelines that we must follow and make to make the air show successful.
Mm. What happens to other kinds of air traffic while the air show is going on? And we should also mention that at least often there's a rehearsal day the day before the actual performances. What happens to, for instance, airplanes flying into the Milwaukee Airport, Mitchell Field? Is it business as usual, or do they have to be, in a sense, altering their plans accordingly to not conflict with what's going on with the air show?
Great question. Of course, we work closely with Milwaukee ATC and FAA to make sure that during the air show, the main part of the air show, which is Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and basically noon to 5, that's what we call the waiver period, when the airspace has specific rules. So there's like a 5-mile ring from the show center, and that includes, of course, Milwaukee Airport. So it's basically during the Blues and Thunderbirds is that 45 minutes is the main thing where the Milwaukee air traffic has to follow some rules. But pretty much business as usual otherwise. So it's really during that 1 hour of the jet team, Thunderbirds, Blue Angels, where you have a kind of a different set of rules where Milwaukee air traffic has to perhaps circle around until that's part of the show is done, meaning Blue Angels, Thunderbirds, jet teams. All the rest of the military aircraft, all the civilian, are pretty much out over the box, over Lake Michigan. Doesn't really affect Milwaukee air traffic that much. And so for the most part, you know, like you said, business as usual for air traffic, except during that 45 minutes of the jet teams.
Hmm. So, for instance, this year's event, which is on July 19th and 20th, are there particular places where people are encouraged to be, to congregate, in order to most effectively or fully enjoy the show?
Absolutely. I mean, Milwaukee's a little different in that we're out over the water, so you have Bradford Beach, McKinley Beach, McKinley Park, along the lakefront there. Other air shows are at airports where they come in and they congregate along a specific runway in what we call the primary spectator area. So Milwaukee Lakefront's a little different. It's a little more of a, what I would say, a gathering where people can kind of almost go anywhere, you know, some grounds all the way to UWM. But most people congregate what we call in the primary area, which is Bradford Beach, McKinley Beach, and McKinley Park. Those are the best areas to watch the Air and Water Show, as you watch out over the water and are looking at Show Center, and that's where the primary performances take place. So Milwaukee's a little different in that case. It's a little bit wider open, whereas, like I said, other air shows have are at airports, so it's a little bit of a smaller spectator area. But Milwaukee's show site is very large, a couple miles long, so it's very unique in that sense.
Right. I should share that 1 year my wife and I were visiting the beautiful art museum right down on the lakeshore, and for some reason it had sort of skipped past us that we were in Milwaukee on one of the days of the Air and Water Show. And so quite by accident, as we were actually leaving the art museum, there above us was the start of that year's Air and Water Show. And it was such a happy surprise and, you know, just dumb luck on our part that we happened to be there and at a pretty good location to take in all that was going on. And I imagine, although there are thousands of people who make a point of attending this and viewing this, that you also, because of its very nature, end up with a whole lot of, in sense, people being pleasantly surprised. Oh, yeah, it's the air show that, today.
Absolutely. I mean, Art Museum is kind of a little bit south of where the box is, so not the best place to watch it. But again, you can watch it pretty much from anywhere on the lakefront. However, at McKinley Park is the best spot. Air and Water Show has reserved seating, flight line, center point, sky chalet to watch the air show, where you get the best seat in the house and you get to support the Air and Water Show by buying a ticket.
Very good. And how does one do that?
Best way would be to go to mkeairwatershow.com. Just click on buy tickets, and that'll take you to the landing page where you can, you know, there's a bunch of choices to buy tickets. Real easy to do, and they send them to you electronically.
And you have, I think quite often at least, have an announcer on hand that gives information about what people are actually seeing, correct?
Absolutely. We do have an air show announcer there every year. Herb Hunter's been there many years. And so he's kind of like your play caller. He'd call all the action and what the aircraft are doing, what the aerobatics are doing. And so that's a big part of the show. We have the entire show site is wired for sound for almost a mile. So no matter where you are down there at the best seats, you have a sound system and a great announcer. Of course, not to also mention, we got lots of food and beverage down there. So we got everything for people that want to come down to the lakefront and enjoy a great show.
Very good. And I imagine that even as this finishes up, you are already thinking about the Air and Water Show for 2026. How long a planning span are we talking about in terms of laying the groundwork for the shows to come?
Great question. And, you know, what we do is, you know, right concluding this summer's Air and Water Show, we'll start right in, you know, the following month and start planning for next year. So it just keeps going. It doesn't stop.
Paul Rogers is founder and president of the Milwaukee Air and Water Show. And this year's show, which is headlined by the U.S. Navy's Blue Angels, will be coming up on July 19th and 20th on the Milwaukee Lakefront. And would you mind giving the website once again where people can get more information and, if they so choose, purchase tickets?
Yes, it's mkeairwatershow.com.
Very good. Paul Rogers, thank you so much. It was great to talk with you. Best wishes to you and everybody involved in this year's Milwaukee Air and Water Show.
Thanks for your time. Great to be with you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I speak with Tamara Gomond, who is co-author of a book called 100 Things to Do in Door County Before You Die, a wonderful guide to Door County and all that there is to do and see there. Also, we'll be hearing about a wonderful fine arts event that's going to be coming up shortly in Williams Bay. Not this weekend, but the next weekend we'll get a little sample of an interview that will air in its entirety next week. And then on Thursday, we're going to be previewing for you the next production to open at the Racine Theater Guild, the wonderful musical Drowsy Chaperone. I'll be speaking with Rob Cruz, who is both music and stage director for this production. And on Friday from the archives, S.E. Hinton, the author of The Outsiders, a wonderful young adult novel that, of course, has been transformed into a marvelous musical. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. You can find the program archived on our website, WGTD.org. And by the way, for those of you that enjoy listening to the podcast version of the program, we're experiencing some technical difficulties. We hope that those difficulties will be resolved shortly so that the podcast can be renewed. We still have podcast episodes available through this past Saturday. On to the weather forecast for southeastern Wisconsin and northeastern Illinois. Today is going to be sunny and hot. We're headed for a high of 88 degrees, partly cloudy overnight with a low of 73. Tomorrow, partly sunny, hot and humid with a 40% chance of afternoon rain. Wednesday's high, 89 degrees, heat index close to 97. Cloudier skies and sharply cooler on Thursday. with a slight chance of rain, and Thursday's high just 73 degrees, 76 for a high on Friday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake.